For almost as long as movies have been made, New York City has been a target for apocalyptic disaster. It's been attacked by every imaginable foe. Giant spiders and robots, zombies, aliens, an ice age, meteor strikes, and debris falling from the moon. There was even a movie for children about a giant bagel that crashed into Times Square. After the terrorist attacks of 9/11 and natural disasters like Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans and Superstorm Sandy here in New York, some of those disaster scenarios didn't sound far-fetched anymore, and the New York Prepper Movement was born. A prepper is the name for someone who is actively preparing for the next disaster that might hit. Early in life, Margaret Ling, a 25-year-old graduate student at Columbia University, saw a tragedy that would lead her into the prepper movement.
I was downtown at my sister's office when the first bombing took place in World Trade Center back in the 80s.
She was only 3 or 4 years old.
That made me wonder, wow. It sounds like a movie. Things that I usually see on a big screen can actually happen in real life.
That bombing in the 80s, that attempt, you were a little kid.
I was young, yes. But I saw all these people running out of the building and the horror in their faces, and it should have been the first wake-up call for most people in the city.
Fears about how disaster could cripple the city are as varied as its residents. Jason Charles, a fireman in the Bronx, started prepping because he was concerned that a massive volcanic eruption in Yellowstone National Park, over 2,000 miles away in Wyoming, could produce a cloud of ash blocking the sun for a prolonged period of time and threaten humanity. He started a group called New York City Preppers Network to rally his community after becoming convinced that an electromagnetic pulse could paralyze the city. For the uninitiated, EMP is?
Electromagnetic pulse. It's where a nuclear device gets launched into the atmosphere and it detonates and it showers the United States with electromagnetic pulse that knocks out power.
As unlikely as that might sound, there are reasons he's taking it seriously.
It's a big to-do once you start researching it. I read a book. It was called One Second After. The afterword in the book by Newt Gingrich talked about the importance of shielding America from an EMP attack and how it's likely to happen, and that how they had reports of terrorists buying this, getting that nuclear warhead, buying shipping containers, and them launching a missile to knock out our power grid. And then you read in the book how people were starving because of lack of being prepared. And you read how the breakdown of society starts. I think it's like a week or two to total collapse, right? There's no structures, no police, no fire, no food. Food and water breaks down within 3 days.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Lou Olkowski, and I've been reporting on life in the U.S. from my home in New York for the past 20 years. New York Times reporter Alan Foyer started to think about disaster preparedness after the economic crash in 2008. It made him realize that our financial systems are much more fragile than we might want to admit.
Do you know that it's possible, not definite, but within the realm of the conceivable, that you could go to the ATM one day and there would be no money there? And are you ready for that? Are you aware that all our money could lose its value, right?
As a journalist, Foyer studied the prepper movement and found that many of them had valid concerns. And while he didn't become a hardcore prepper, he did become what he calls a semi-prepper.
And for $100, they will send you a month's supply of dehydrated food delivered to your door in both regular and vegetarian options, should you want it. Who cares? Why not, right?
RJ Cody is a spokesman for the International Preparedness Network, one of the largest prepper organizations in the country. And they hold training sessions on things like how to store adequate food supplies and how to plan your personal escape route. An IT specialist by trade, his biggest concern is a cyber attack.
I don't think we're prepared for that. It's not that it will never happen, it's when will it happen. These are the same sources of enemy that we've saw in the past. It's just taking on a new battlefield, if you will. That battlefield being in the computers that we rely on for our livelihood, for our health, for clean water. And when those computers are affected by these attackers, are we prepared to be able to support that same system without the digital helpers that we've come dependent on? And that's a dangerous place. If those computers shut down, there will be loss of life. When those things are at risk, and they are right now, you know, are we prepared for that?
I was born a shotgun in my hands.
This music is from the Watchmen of America's website. The Watchmen is a prepper group that's structured almost like a militia, with local chapters reporting into a national leadership organization with a standardized training plan.
Born and raised in New York, and I've always been a prepper and being a survivalist.
Mrs. Tepp, head of the New York chapter, shares the concerns of many preppers, that the United States government isn't adequately prepared for natural disaster. We spoke one evening by phone when a polar vortex blanketed much of the United States, forcing New Yorkers indoors because of extreme cold temperatures.
Was there a moment that said, this is the time now?
The time for me was when I witnessed Katrina, when I saw what went on down there and I saw the lack of help. Nobody was prepared for anything like this. And then I see up here when we had Sandy and things like that, and these people were not prepared.
Just how valid are these preppers' concerns? For a reality check, we spoke with Dr. Erwin Redlener, author of Americans at Risk, Why We Are Not Prepared for Mega Disasters. As the director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University, it's his job to study our readiness for calamity.
If somebody says, I believe it's possible that we could have an EMP, electromagnetic pulse, and a massive shutdown of the power grid, that is factually correct. That could happen. And it could also happen that, you know, we could be visited from, you know, by some other species from outside the solar system. There are things that you can't say irrefutably won't happen. So I guess what's gone on with the prepper movement, so to speak, is people latching on to the possibility of very rare events and really choosing to spend their time and resources to protect themselves or to ready themselves for such events.
A unique challenge for preppers in New York is that the city is a collection of islands. How do you get out if disaster disables mass transit and automobiles are clogging the already trafficked roadways and bridges? Jason Charles, who we met earlier, lives in Upper Manhattan, which means he would only have to cross one body of water to get to the mainland in the Bronx or New Jersey.
And do you have a walking route planned for you and your family? You've got two kids, a dog.
You don't have one, you have dozens.
So what's the way out from here?
I can't tell you that. You never tell people that.
And what's the risk that, like, they would follow you and be like, oh, that guy's prepared, I'm not, so I'm going to find that guy and grab all his stuff?
People do interesting things in disasters.
Do you have a way out by water if you can't walk across a bridge?
We're not swimming across. We have a raft, so... On foot, rafting, and car.
Tommy DeLallo runs a gym and a prepper group. He lives on Long Island, essentially a dead end to the Atlantic Ocean.
We are the pretty much the only place in the United States that can't get out. We have bridges that we have to get over. The people started to revolt against the government. They would have to blow the bridges and then secure a bridge and have to create martial law, and everybody would be stuck here. And then they'll be going looting, and they don't know what to loot. They're going to, you know, you saw Hurricane Katrina. They were going in, pulling out, when we had TVs and beer and sneakers. It's horrible. We have it all figured out as far as what to take care of if it is. Unfortunately, looting's going to be a part of it. We kind of have to do it, but we're not going to be savages about it. We're not going to go around killing people and stuff like that. No, we're about surviving for ourselves. If we're attacked, there's no law to protect these people anymore, and there's no law to protect me. So I'm going to do whatever it takes, by any means necessary, to protect my family and my friends.
Oh, we are one of the last remaining symbols of America's freedom, the Watchmen of America.
For Tommy DeLallo, it's us against them. That mindset is common in the prepper movement. The Watchmen of America also believe that being prepared involves confronting an enemy. Here's Freebird, their first commanding officer.
You've got two major aspects you're going to have to consider here. One, you've got the large number of criminal element that's in our country. You've got Middle Eastern terrorist organizations that function in our country. Mm-hmm. You've got the numerous gangs of all ethnic backgrounds. And you've got your everyday common criminals that usually will seize upon any opportunity when a major disaster takes place. We saw that in Katrina. They fell victim to the criminal element. You're facing this criminal element and the government comes in and takes away your weapons, then you have no ability to defend yourself. I've got to fight not only the criminal element that may want to come and take what I have, but I've got to fight the government to keep them from taking my way of defending myself. That's what's happening in America today.
You're listening to Preparing for Disaster on the BBC World Service with me, Lou Olkowski. Tommy DeLallo, the gym owner from Long Island, started his own prepper group. It's exclusive, by invitation only. He says his group includes mechanics, chefs, physicians, engineers, and ex-Marines. From the basement of the gym, where a class in hand-to-hand combat is going on, he tells us about the secret compound where his group will reconvene during an emergency, but he won't reveal its location.
We can fit at least 100 people there, no problem. We learn the hard things, how to daisy chain truck batteries so we can get electrical grid going, how to purify water, how to recycle those types of waters, the dark water, the gray water, the clean water, and use them accordingly. And then we have a full medical staff, surgeons that are on our team. We learn primitive skills. We want to think about what blacksmiths used to do. We want to think about how they survived in the 1700s without electricity, not about technology, what battery operated or crank or solar power. We can survive indefinite at this facility. It's that kind of a compound, indefinite. So if there was a nuclear exchange, it would take us pretty much 25 minutes to get to our location. Then we would have to secure the perimeter and get everybody in there. And only the strong survive, unfortunately. The moral codes have to go into the toilet. It's about survival. And that's what it's really about. China once said why they don't invade, and it's a smart thing, is because behind every blade of grass is an American with a rifle. And that's the truth.
Would the Watchmen also defend themselves with arms?
Absolutely. Anybody who wouldn't is nothing more than they call them victims or corpses. I would primarily say that most all of our state groups do train with weapons. We have problems and situations in various states where they have extremely controlling gun laws that prevent that from happening. So they use other alternative means to practice weapons use and tactics and things of that nature. But that is the primary concern that, you know, in a disastrous situation, when chaos befalls us and we're facing angry mobs of looters and criminals and things, you have to protect yourself. So weapons training, safety in using those weapons is extremely important. And I'd say all of them are active in doing so.
Back in the gym, Tommy DeLallo and his pal, also named Tommy, show us how their group trains with weapons.
It's the same weight as a real rifle would be. So it has a single shot where you can fire it just once. And then you also have the ability to shoot full auto. We're making our own bows as well. For more of the, when we're out of ammo in the years after the disaster occurs.
Whoa.
That's instant death. I mean, not just death. I mean, it would just be the equivalent of getting shot.
And there's all different types of tips you could put on these. You got razor tips, razor backs that will hit you, and anything it hits, it just cuts right through, no problem.
But this is to drop deer 5 times our size.
You may not be a prepper now, but you will be. Whether the next disaster is man-made or wrought by Mother Nature, you need a plan.
In emergencies, store shelves can empty in hours. How would you feed your family?
Introducing Wise Company Gourmet Emergency Food. Comfort food with a shelf life up to 25 years.
Preppers love their stuff. And it's not just the gourmet freeze-dried food. There's a tremendous amount of gear available for purchase. Gadgets for every imaginable purpose. For Alan Foyer, the New York Times reporter, it's this fascination with survival gear that defines the prepper.
Well, if I get the, you know, bacterial disinfectant, then I'm still susceptible to viral infection. And if I get this particular hand crank radio, well, it doesn't have the you know, cell phone charger adapter. You know, it's just like this endless unfolding of plans and possibilities. it's a neurosis, I think. You know what I mean? Because it's endless, you know?
The first order of business for any prepper is to assemble a good bug-out bag with everything you need to survive for a few days to a week. Fireman Jason Charles keeps three different bags packed, waiting for the day that he, his wife, two kids, and their dog Tyler need to escape.
Yeah. This bug-out bag is the original.
It's the first bug-out bag he ever assembled before he had a wife and kids.
I carry solar charger. How you purify your water? Right? This is a UV sterilizer. So if there's any bacteria or germs in it, the UV light will kill it.
Like, I have to say, like, this is the most intricately packed bag. Like, this, can you get everything out and then back in?
You should know where everything goes. Almost blindfolded, you know, like. Then this is like a 10-gallon folding bucket. Thought it was a cool thing to have. Emergency blanket. This medical kit. This is a stove. It's called a firebox. Folds out into a full stove and you can cook a meal on it. Every bag should have this. This is a radio / flashlight. Solar charged. And you can also crank charge it as well. All right.
Like, because this is your bug out bag, but like, how are you prepared to bug in?
This is where we keep most of our stuff.
Okay, so this is the hall closet?
Yeah, it's the end of the world closet.
How long could you guys live out of this closet?
9 months.
9 months?
9 months.
That's crazy.
I couldn't help but wonder, with all that food and water, would he share?
If we had a situation that lasted a month, could we help other people out? Yes. Would we? Depends. Depends on who they are. You know, if they're the scumbag that sits on the corner, does nothing all day? Absolutely not. If I like you and you're on the list, I'm going to help you out. If I don't like you, you're on your own.
Even someone like journalist Alan Foyer, who only considers himself a semi-prepper, has spent a lot of time and money on his survival kit. Like lots of preppers, he bought silver coins in the event that paper money becomes worthless.
I had 30 grand in coins at one point. It's called a monster box. You can go on to the U.S. Mint website.
How big is it?
3 feet by 2 feet, weighs enough that you could easily throw your back out picking it up. And they're mint issued silver eagles, they're called. The idea is like, hey man, I got some silver. You have some garbanzo beans. Let's make a deal.
While most preppers are ready to get out of Dodge in a moment's notice, there's still the concern. What might they encounter when they arrive on the other side of the river? Dr. Erwin Redlener from the National Center for Disaster Preparedness.
There are communities all over the United States that have said if there's a disaster that requires evacuating, let's say, large cities because of some event, don't even think about coming into our communities. You know, there's been talk about, you know, local sheriffs blocking the exit from highways into particular communities. You know, you're not coming here. If there was a pandemic flu and people were trying to escape New York City, they were going to dump big piles of sand and gravel on the highways coming into the communities.
They are prepping for Armageddon.
Fire! Fire, yo!
The apocalypse.
Go, go!
The end of the world as we know it.
Despite the seriousness of the preppers' concerns, they're often portrayed as objects of freakish delight in popular media, like the TV show Doomsday Preppers on the National Geographic Channel. Its executive producer, Alan Madison.
So the majority of our preppers are white, middle-aged men between
35 and 65. Sometimes I like to say that it's the same demographic as a serial killer. I really don't feel that we're shaping the material to make them look crazy at all.
Do you ever try to protect them from looking crazy?
No. No. I mean, I think that would be lying by, you can lie by commission, which is make him look crazy, or lie by omission and make him not look crazy, and I try to do neither.
Mainstream media doesn't seem to share the preppers' concerns. Perhaps one reason is the preppers' attitudes towards the government and to authority. People like R.J. Cody and Tommy DeLallo believe the authorities would ignore them or even turn against them in a crisis.
You have to be responsible for your own survival because the government's not going to do that. You know, Department of Homeland Security is not going to secure anything but their own assets. And the people who are in the wrong neighborhood or on the wrong side of things are simply going to be left out, like the people were in Katrina, like we were in Sandy. And I see what's going to happen if we have another event. We're not going to be reliant upon some outside entity to maintain those sensibilities for us.
I'm not relying on any government assistant during any type of disaster. I'm relying on my skill. I've seen what they do even with government programs. We don't have to have a disaster to see what the disaster would look like. We can just look at the educational system. We can look at the Medicare system here that's going on, the medical situation there that we're trying to do what Europe is doing. And it's not going to work in America. These are not great things. And basically what's happening is that you're creating a cluster of anarchy. It's just like a cat being thrown into a corner. It's going to attack your face. It's really going to attack you. And that's how the revolution started.
What should we make of this movement and the preppers who worry so deeply about their safety? And why do these groups seem so prevalent now? Journalist Alan Foyer.
Stuff works until all of a sudden it doesn't. As a nation, we've lost our know-how, and I don't mean our intelligence. I literally mean our know-how. We don't know how to do stuff anymore. Some people don't know how to change a tire, let alone, you know, fix a spark plug or replace a spark plug, you know, let alone grow their own food, sew their own clothes. With the fragility of complex systems married to a lack of know-how in the aggregate, you've got like a recipe for people being screwed if things go wrong.
Or like, being scared.
Well, I mean, being scared because they realize they could be screwed. They realize how vulnerable they are, how much autonomy has been removed from the self and outsourced to everyone from the law enforcement system to the local grocery store. Everything we have, we get somewhere else. But when it doesn't work, you're crippled. And so that's my sense of what people are feeling.
But for Irwin Redlener and Alan Madison, it's not just concern over our reliance on technology that has preppers worried. They say the angst lies deeper in the American psyche.
I have a feeling that it's sort of uniquely present here in the U.S. The U.S. nurtures the outliers in a certain way. You know, people that want to be independent, do their own thing, and be outside the mainstream, and be, you know, critical of government. All of these kinds of thoughts, which have actually spurred the development of really very conservative right-wing and isolationist elements like our Tea Party movement here in the U.S. It's all part of this mistrust of government. It's people that actually grow up like that and children who have been exposed to that and will sort of inherit those same attitudes.
There have been 5 events that have happened in the last 10 years that don't even happen in people's whole generations, starting with 9/11, the attack of the American mainland by a foreign force. Then the destruction of an American city, Katrina. Then 2008, the economic collapse, which has not happened since 1930. And then the election of Barack Obama. And then the 5th thing is the internet. And these 5 things have conspired to basically unmoor people.
The election of Barack Obama is lumped in with disasters.
Changes. And the internet is not a disaster. And people often stop me on that one and say, oh, so you're saying that there's a large portion of the United States that's racist. I think it goes beyond racism. And to me, that's just my personal point of view, that it's almost as if you walked outside and there wasn't gravity. And that's how people view it.
For university student Margaret Ling, who has such deep concerns about her safety. Has her prepping brought reassurance?
It has, because I notice some days I just leave my carrying kit. I feel like I have an arm missing. So it is a part of my life. I've turned it into a lifestyle.
The general mood among New York's prepper community doesn't seem optimistic. But maybe, given the trauma the city's faced in recent years, we should take their concerns more seriously, or at least consider the dangers of living in a megacity. After all, New York is just one of many.
Right now, it's pretty scary out there. It's pretty scary, especially here in the state of New York. Economically, the New Yorkers are in bad shape. I don't foresee anything good happening right now.
We want to continue to live this life of luxury that we've got here in New York, but we're not ready for the interruption of, you know, little things like power. What we don't see is enough people being enraged about the lack of preparation, that as a city, as a country, we are simply not even having that conversation, and that needs to change.
Preparing for Disaster on the BBC World Service. I'm Lou Olkowski, and the producer was Anthony Denslow.